Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You scared of things that go boom, boom, boom?
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
My name is Eric.
Eric's my favorite.
I'm here with Michael, ready to lay down on the floor for another double feature. Michael, what's going on in the world, man?
So contrary to popular belief, today's show has nothing to do with the much-renowned Bongi Westfall universe. These are sort of unofficial entries into the Bongi Westfall universe. So the Bongi Westfall universe covers Evil Bong and all of the films associated with it. So this is Good Bong.
Right.
So we're going to cover...
Retroactively, all the other Bong movies have a mustache now.
Right,
so.
Right. So those are what's going on?
That's the Bizarro Bong universe. Please update the Wikipedia page.
What's going on in the world? So a few days ago, I think approximately 7 days ago, we said something dumbly, of course, because every time we open our mouth and put it down on recording, the opposite happens. Mm-hmm. We said, nothing is changing. This is all starting to seem like the same shit. And now you don't get to leave your house until July. And Texas opened up a week ago. So we are in two different planets. And
good. So we're back to being in two different planets. Everything is just totally
right.
Normal.
Well, but the difference is one of our planets is spiraling into the fucking sun. And the other one is imploding. So we'll see which planet survives better.
Well, rest assured, dear listener, we are here with you with two substantial films today. So world be damned. I think the content of these films, unlike some of our recent shows, are going to completely fucking dwarf the world around them.
Yeah.
Let me just do the temperature check, right? We have not spoiled the last few movies. Now, I don't know where you want to lay your bet, but let's just like fucking rock, paper, scissors this right on the show. Mm-hmm. I think we should spoil these movies.
Yeah, they're going to get mad spoiled.
These contain just wonderful, inventive scenes. If you haven't watched the movies, you should see them because I'm going to want to talk about these scenes.
Right.
There's no way that I'm not going to want to point at specific things going on in these movies.
And I think that is actually sort of specific aspect of what we're actually doing today is we're looking at the some films of Bong Joon-ho. So if you're not familiar with Bong Joon-ho, he was the filmmaker behind the film Parasite, which was very popular, very well received, and very good. It was all of those things, which is super cool when that kind of all aligns. And he is also most famously on our show, more famously than having covered The Host way back before when he was just a tiny bong, he is famously responsible.
Really, just the word bong is just funny. There's no, you don't even have to make a joke out of it. It's just say tiny bong. It's just funny. There's just everybody, you know, as soon as Parasite got big, everybody did their like, haha, 420 joke film fest.
Yeah.
And it turns out that they were doing too much work. Just say bong. Bong is a funny word. That's right. Really all you need.
So not specifically is he well known on our show for the film The Host, but he is in fact mostly famous on Double Feature for the phrase, the 1-inch barrier.
Ah, yes.
Which we have subjected you to, we realize.
Quite a bit.
For the last few weeks. So thanks for reading the movies.
Although technically there will be subtitles next week, right? Although they'll be in a different typeface if I'm...
Yeah, there'll be subtitles for a different reason.
We promise it's not like the last 10,000 episodes. But look, you know, I am finding... We don't have to waste a lot of time on this, but... Oh, also the movies are Barking Dogs Never Bite and Mother. I guess that's right. Important, mm-hmm. Right?
Sure, good call.
I am finding, maybe kind of counterintuitively, that it is easier to watch subtitled films right now because they are so demanding of my attention.
Right.
Now, you can also fail to watch a subtitle film in a way that you can't you know, quite fail to just put on a movie and then sort of drift and come back to it. But if you are reading the subtitles, you are locked into the film. And so it's been, as a person who is having trouble getting away from the world and just zoning out and, you know, zoning out's not even the phrase I want, right? Paying attention right. to a movie, you know?
Right.
Not being on my phone, like all the stuff that we've been talking about. These have been helpful for that. And I found these to be incredibly engaging films. But we don't expect that people have done their Bong Joon-ho homework.
Bong Joon homework, please.
I know. I just try not to make a bunch of Shyamalan-esque jokes that we'll look back on in 10 years and go, oh, fucking delete that episode. You know what? If it takes theaters making Bong jokes to get them to play his movies, if that's the sort of devil's bargain that we have to make to do this, fine. That's what it is. Anyways, my point was just that I'm happy with this show also being a first-time perspective.
Right.
Don't be afraid of these films just because they're maybe a little bit different than what you've been watching, or because they are, you know, I think these are very rich, maybe not layered necessarily, but yeah. very rich and very mm-hmm. thematic
yeah,
movies.
I think this is interesting. Bong Joon-ho is a really interesting director to cover in a director-centric episode.
Mm-hmm.
In that you can come at him from either angle. You can come at him from, I have only seen Parasite, and then watch these two movies and really get something from them, both from an auteuristic standpoint, but also just from a watching amazing cinema standpoint. Or you can come in totally blind and go, I don't know this guy, watch these two movies and have a pretty good idea of what Parasite might be like. I do feel like despite the pandemic, Bong Joon-ho is still presently synonymous with Parasite
mm-hmm.
in the modern day. So mm-hmm. I apologize if I bring up Parasite more on the show. I'm going to try not to bounce stuff off of it too much or spoil it, but I just feel like as a reference point, that's where a lot of people's flag is sitting.
Yeah, but just the act of watching these two movies, I mean, the similarity, like the signature is going to become a lot more apparent, I think, with these two in particular.
Right.
And that's a great part about watching them coming to this director for the first time, or for myself even, you know, I've seen some of his other movies. We've covered some of them. And I also really liked Parasite, but I just felt like I didn't know the guy's work very well.
Mm-hmm.
He's a writer, director. He has a very distinct voice. And I watched even a couple more films. And I think these two in particular were very good for drilling down on kind of the makeup of what these films really are.
Yeah, I mean, specifically for me, it's a lot of the idiosyncrasies of what he does. It sort of puts a magnifying glass over what becomes minutiae later in his career.
So we cover, there's going to be spoilers. There's a Patreon, patreon.com/double feature. Thanks for helping on that. Again, I will give the constant plugs of the Patreon a bit of a break. But I did want to take a little bit of time. Someone has given back to the film community here, and I just wanted to update everybody on the state of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Very recently, our non-official official theater of Double Feature
right.
that everybody's been getting behind, the Alamo Drafthouse, our current stand-in, has also taken a look at some of the recent shows or recent topics that we've covered and noticed that yeah, all this virtual stuff was not quite up to par and maybe needs a little bit of cleanup. So they have a new effort out.
Sorry, I was trying to look it up to see what it was called. Is it called Alamo at Home or is it called like
Draft? Alamo On Demand.
On Demand, that's what it is, sorry.
Mm.
Yeah, so Alamo Drafthouse started their own, I guess it's a VOD service. It's not quite the, what's the fucking stupid website cinema thing called?
Virtual cinema.
It's not virtual cinema. It's definitely like sort of a curated VOD thing that still feels very Drafthouse when you look at collections because it has sort of new releases. They're Fantastic Fest features. They're doing sort of an Ozploitation feature looking at Australian exploitation movies. And then they have the films of Bong Joon-ho, which is very obviously something they're going to do because Tim League, who is the former CEO of Drafthouse, owns Neon Films, who produced and distributed Parasite. to much acclaim. So there's Parasite again.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of think of it the way, you know, we had a service like Pandora before Spotify and Apple Music.
Yeah.
You know, both of them just kind of like let you stream movies. But as we've been looking through a lot of these solutions recently, or even to compare this to an established VOD, you know, where we have, you can buy a movie on Amazon Prime or even iTunes, which I think is kind of a gold standard of a storefront to go buy a digital movie. This is like, all right, what if we took that, but we added curation?
Mm-hmm.
And so you go on this and look, I'll just let people go to the website. It's drafthouse.com. They can click through and find it. But guys, you're going to be excited by this because it just looks like the double feature webpage. It's just a bunch of fucking movies that we have done and would do if we could pair them up correctly.
To be completely fair, there is another service that is an unofficial sponsor of Double Feature that did very curated lists like this. And we also really like that streaming service. Just want to point it out.
There's a lot of good places to find content, but this made me, you know, this made me really happy because we've been looking at all these different solutions week after week, and sort of the unspoken thing is they kind of suck.
Yeah.
You know, this is like an emergency. This is not a stable, is ad hoc the word I want? I don't know what the word I'm looking for is. It's nice. They did a nice job. Go take a look at it. I don't know which things you want to talk about of the many things in Barking Dogs Never Bite, but let me just give you my my sort of, don't call it a pet issue, my pet issue with this movie. I'm going to preface this. I'm going to give you a preface. I live in Los Angeles. People know this on the show. Not only do I live in Los Angeles, but I'm a vegan. Over the amount of time that our show has gone on, I have increasingly come to the idea that humans have a kind of a moral responsibility to protect other creatures that are not as smart as humans, animals. And I'm finding myself just being increasingly extremist about that position. I lay all of that groundwork because it is always fascinating to me that some people find it so hard to watch animals have make-believe harm done to them in film.
Oh, okay, cool. I'm glad this is where you're going.
I just want to, you know, it's such a big part of the movie. It's really the, you know, it's in the plot synopsis, the basic plot synopsis of the movie. Five words of a plot synopsis has to mention some kind of harm to animals. And, you know, when you harm animals in a film, I mean, we're really just talking about animals playing pretend. And I find it so weird that so many people draw a red line there. They go, if an animal is being harmed in this film, I will not watch the film.
Right.
Even though these movies all go out of their way to say, no animals were actually harmed in the making of the film. We are playing pretend.
Mm-hmm.
They just don't like the pretend idea. They don't like animals acting in any kind of negative light.
Right.
It is just kind of, it's the cinematic equivalent of roll over, play dead.
Let me be really.
It bothers people.
So Barking Dogs Never Bite is Bong Joon-ho's first film from way, 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 way back in the year 2000.
Mm-hmm.
In the year 2000, the first thing you see on a film involving animals being harmed is, yo, we're not hurting the animals. That's what you see in the year 2000. Now, if you recall, up until March, when you went to a movie now that came out now, you don't see that because even a dog is fucking CG now. So, I'm serious.
We have the
people that you're speaking of have argued films into CGing birds because birds and pigs and cats and, you know, to a more understandable extent, tigers and apes and whatever don't have the ability to consent to acting. And so all animals in cinema are exploiting animals. You know, it's like the same as fucking child labor to a certain degree by your standards. So Barking Dogs Never Bite is not only a film that shows animals being harmed and uses real animals, but it's for whatever reason, I don't know if this is the point you were going at, but the for whatever reason, watching this happen is just funny.
Well, it provokes, I mean, all right, so we're going to start talking about specific scenes. I didn't even make it this far. I already have to do it. Throwing the dog off the roof provokes a huge reaction from me. And this is, I guess, why this divide continues to be so fascinating, why some people would see a scene like a dog flying off the roof and go, no, I will not support the rest of this film because I do not like the event that happens in the story. And I don't have, I mean, I guess part of it is funny to me because it's so extreme, but I have the reaction that the film kind of thinks I'm going to have, which is, oh my God, don't throw that dog off the roof. Is he really going to throw a dog off the roof? This is, no, stop that man. Don't let him do it. And then the dog flies off the roof and my mouth hangs open. But I guess where I come from is I want to have huge reactions. I'm looking for a film to give me a huge, I watch films to not be dead. You know what I mean?
Sure.
So I want a film to do a big thing, a scary thing, an impressive thing, a thing I love, a thing I fucking hate. I want to go to movies and feel something. And when you fling a dog off the roof, it turns out we look into my soul and I fucking feel something. There are so many of those scenes, not in regards to just doing weird things to dogs, but I feel like one of the things that I picked up watching these movies is that so many scenes in both films that are so memorable, you know, in a way that it made me think back to like one of the first real movie experiences I had was watching Pulp Fiction. And how that is a movie of just, it's so quotable. You can do a sketch of every scene. It just has such big scenes. And what's really pretty incredible and actually maybe a little bit similar about a lot of the scenes in these two movies is some of them play really big with a prop or with a character piece or with an unbelievable action. But a lot of them are also just people talking that are the most memorable moments. Or something that's incredibly mundane, you know? So contrast throwing a dog off the roof with the 100 meters scene, which is just the two of them talking and eventually rolling, I don't even know what the fuck that is, toilet paper down a hill. And that scene just sticks out so much in my head and it makes a memorable moment out of nothing, out of two people having a conversation that isn't even really that important. I don't think. Who knows with these movies, but not even that important. But it's one prop, two people having an argument. It's a whole vignette itself. Like you could just do that scene.
Right.
And it's incredibly memorable. And, you know, I think that has a lot of real staying power to it.
The scenes that you're talking about, the human scenes, are the actual meat of the movie and the, what would you call it? What would be like the Latin term for fucking killing dogs?
You know, I bring a couple pieces of information to the show, and now you just assume I know fucking Latin. I don't know what. Why did this fall on? This burden is not mine.
Whatever that is,
just because I occasionally write some notes down doesn't mean I'm just going to show up one day and be like, oh yes, I know Latin as well.
The dog slaughter is just decor.
Yeah.
To, you know, the meat of the movie. This, it's funny too. So one of the things that really struck me.
To Shen, that is, no, I don't know.
Thank you. Yeah. One of the things that really struck me about barking dogs than that really I thought was odd is a lot of these super, super visionary directors, really, really, stylistic visionary directors. I'm not talking about Scorsese. Their first film all has a really similar vibe. And I'm talking about Devil's Backbone. Mm-hmm. Nope, that's not the... Is that the name of it? The Del Toro?
Yeah, the one... I was going to say the one with Ron Perlman, but...
No.
Or is that the bomb one? That's the bomb, one.
The bomb one. Devil's Backbone. Another one that really comes to mind for me is Delicatessen.
Oh, yeah.
The Jean-Pierre Jeunet. You know, you got to get your hyphenated directors in here. They're all the same dude.
Yes, yes.
But they have this vibe, and I don't know if it's because they have similar budgets and they came out around the same time, so they had similar technology, or if it's because when you're a visionary director doing your first piece, your limitations funnel your vision into a similar place. Because they're not about the same thing. They all sort of, they sort of have this inhuman sort of almost surrealistic element that feels like it wants to be what's going on in the movie, but is forced to take a backseat to the more accessible human drama that is cheaper to create and produce.
Yeah, but also I think in a lot of these movies ends up being the part that shines.
Absolutely.
Ends up being when you go to see the movie, you don't expect it to sort of get the just the normal patter.
Right.
Correct. You think, oh, this is going to be, if I'm not sold on this weird dog hook, then I'm not going to be down for the movie. Yeah, I mean, I'm constantly impressed by how much the stuff of two characters talking, you know, the Boiler Kim scene. I mean, it's literally just two guys in the dark telling a story, and it milks the story for an unusually long amount of time, by the way.
Yeah.
And then builds a really good scare out of fucking nothing, out of nothing's going on, just out of like a person being spooked because they just heard a story. But there's also, you know, the moments that are left up to visual technique or are, I don't know, they don't really, I guess they don't, they fall somewhere in maybe a third category. But what we're finding is, okay, there's sort of a larger idea that's a bit of a hook to it, or at least something kind of wild, something sort of wild, punchy, you put it on the cover. And then the character interactions and really the like meat and potatoes of how a movie gets done ends up to be much better than anybody expected. I don't mean to give that as a backwards compliment. It's great. It's great. It manages to be great, but also you didn't expect that it was going to be great. You probably didn't even expect it was going to be good. And so you're getting your ass kicked. But then like all visual people that you mentioned as well. And even the tricks that, you know, for a drama, okay, I'll give you one. There's a really good thing that I think is subtle enough that maybe people don't catch it, but it's super fucking impressive to me. There's that scene towards the end of the movie where he's running ahead of the girl and he's kind of going like, hey, you recognize this? Do you remember, you know, back of my head, is this ringing any bells for you? Which is also just like, it's already good. The scene, I've not described anything yet and it's good. But the way that they sort, there's a kind of a tell in that moment where they are framing the character just slightly askew in a subtle way that calls back to really the only other time that was done in the movie, which was, you know, the audience will remember it back from that chase scene. And so when they show her chasing him, there is a beat in here. This is a very hard way to convey an epiphany, but there's a beat in here that is, the way it plays is her epiphany, that she's going to realize this is the same guy. And how are we going to show her realizing that without going, oh, I realize this. We just want to see it on her face and know it. And so once the camera kind of locks in that same position, it's using that visual language where the audience has now like matched it. They could overlay them on top of each other, these two scenes. And so they kind of see that and they see her reaction. And you just know it nails this very difficult to pull off sort of visual maneuver to get the audience to go, oh, she understands it now, to let the audience know she's had the epiphany. And then already impressive, already really impressive thing, hard thing to do. But then they throw it away because the end little beat on that scene is like a twist on that moment, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you have to be so sure that the audience now knows, 100% of the audience knows that she's had the epiphany without confirming it, you know, really on paper, without any kind of announcing that she's confirmed it, or like the film does earlier in the movie where she actually flashes back, or they flash back to that moment. So that you have to pull the magic trick on the entire audience to get them to go, oh, she's realized this now, only to then twist that moment and kind of just like throw away the impossible thing that you've just done. It's such fucking icing on the cake. It's so good. Barking Dogs is so good.
I told you it was good.
It's got a moody jazz score.
Super weird. It's funny because I watched this movie 20 years after it came out, and it still felt like, where the fuck did this shit come from? Which is, I'm sure, how people felt 20 years ago.
It's the best when this happens. It fills me with such inspiration, so much like goodwill towards cinema to go,
right,
oh, there are things like from 20 fucking years ago I still don't know about. And I always feel like, oh my God, I've seen everything. There's nothing new under the sun. And then this guy's just been hanging out making his movies. I haven't fucking seen him. And then even once I watch a few,
right,
it takes a while to get back to that. And you watch, right, and it just kicks your ass.
Right. So Mother is the one of all Bong Joon-ho films, maybe without Parasite. Mother is the one that I've always kind of just been like, I need to watch this. I need to watch Mother. I want to see Mother. Fucking James Gunn, who is a person I really like, whenever anybody asks what his favorite movies are, modern, you know, contemporary movies, but movies, I mean, in general, Mother is always on the list, but when they're talking about like modern day films, Mother is usually toward the top, if not number one. And that alone was enough to make me kind of want to see it, but it's like many films from Korea and Japan and China and Thailand and, you know, places you have to read the movies. Those movies are hard to come by sometimes. Streaming services don't necessarily clamor to them, and usually end up
they're not pushed on you.
Right.
Even if you wanted to watch Mother at some point before now, maybe you could find it, but it's not like every time you sign into fucking Netflix, it's like, you want to watch Mother? What about Mother?
Right.
You want to watch Mother? You should watch Mother. Sure. Because, man, I do feel like
I don't find out what the fuck happened to Monday, my Netflix is going to blow up.
Well, they were missing the exclamation point after Mother. That's apparently the thing you needed to get that hit on the front fucking page every time.
God damn.
It's true.
So, yeah, so I finally got to put it on the show and sit down and watch Mother. And turns out, I mean, let's not pretend we're surprised. We've already done an hour and 40 minutes of Bong Joon-ho. It's fucking good.
Yeah, it's great.
It's crazy good.
But that also happened today on the show, because after I watched the last movie, I'm going, well, that was exceptionally good. It's a shame I have to watch Mother now, because there's no way I'm going to like it as much.
Right.
And then Mother, you know, later in his career, he's advanced further, and it's even more complicated.
Mm-hmm.
Which, I mean, of course, you know, I never want to pit the two movies against each other or say which one's better, but I think we look at the two and we go like, oh, there's a fucking lot to unpack in Mother.
Well, listen, that's the thing about cinema in the fourth dimension as an auteur. If you, I don't know if you're 100% subscribed to this sort of mentality, but for me, when I look at auteuristic filmmakers, directors, writers, people who have a considerable amount of control over their films, I look at them the same way I look at fucking gorillas. And, you know, the band, not an animal.
Not the, yeah.
Gorillas with a Z.
That's a hard Z on the end. Thank you. Okay.
So,
same page.
So, Gorillas' self-titled record with fucking Clint Eastwood on it, which you guys probably know, have heard. That's like it's a fine record and it's good. But then like they put out a new record and suddenly I go, I don't want to listen to that old one that much now, because this new one feels like they have advanced to this point. And I use Gorillaz as a prime example, because every time they put out an album, I kind of look back at their old album and go, it sounds like that was made with toys and this was made with instruments. Yeah,
it's crazy.
And that's how I look at filmmakers as well. Like, from fucking Bong Joon-ho to Tarantino to Tim Burton, like, there is a level of advancement and you go, okay, so you did this thing, but then like, what did you do different, better, or next? And Tarantino, you know, while everybody says Pulp Fiction is super good, to me, it just feels fucking old.
Mm-hmm.
And Hateful Eight feels fucking fresh to me.
Yeah.
So fuck you.
Everybody was on the same page until you said Tim Burton, and now they're not sure what you mean.
Well, so that's the thing. So I wanted, yeah. So the Tim Burton thing I think is also interesting because I look at Tim Burton the same way I look at a band like Kiss or Alice Cooper, who were fucking super rad when they were gritty and broke in the 70s. And then when things got polished in the 80s, I fell off the fucking boat.
Yeah.
You know? And they sort of have a voice that makes sense with certain instrumentation. But once things become modern, their vision, their true vision is disparate from what I want to be watching. So to go back to your fucking point, Barking Dogs Never Bite is the debut album, but like Mother is when he's got fucking Steve Albini behind the mixing board.
Yeah, it's pretty wild because it does ring the same way as, you know, you have this almost consciousness shaking initial hit, mm-hmm. you know, this thing that comes out and you're really kind of blown away. And then as the tools advance or the thinking advances or the craftsmanship or the individual vision, the levels of, you know, how many layers more complicated you can get really does end up being, I mean, this is what makes these filmmakers so fascinating. Not just great when they had this initial thing that went out there and you went, wow, yeah, that's a really solid movie. But now Mother is the kind of movie that just, I mean, I go back to, it has so much to unpack. You know, the similarities, I think if you just watch the two movies, do yourself a favor, watch the two movies. Even if you spoiled yourself on the last one, it's great, watch it anyways. But you know, you see that stuff, I won't exhaustively go through it, but you see a lot of these weird same sort of like the mirror on the car and the whatever. It's like the characters in the beginning of this movie just finished watching the last right. movie and are doing gags about it. I mean, there's, you know, it's just set up as such a nice little bridge. But I think you start to see a lot of the ideas the director's interested in, visual icons. You know, he wrote and directed these movies, so it does put him in that camp you're talking about. I also think Mother is fascinating in a different way because it really made me look at his characters for the first time. You know, I knew when I saw Parasite, that's a movie that's kind of got weird, interesting character stuff going on at the heart of it. But it was always, honestly, I'm just too lazy. It was just like, oh, that's going to require a lot of my attention to really sit there and go like, what the fuck's happening here? So I'll just look at the broad themes of that movie. And with Mother, it's so easy to look at the central character. Mother, let's call her. You know, we don't see, first of all, we don't see a woman this age in cinema very often as the central character. Mm-hmm. And you know what? Even when we do, because I feel like we've had that conversation before, you know, we see a woman who's, I don't know, let's say 50s, 60s, you know, a lot of our like 70s, 80s horror actresses we're seeing kind of come back in a sort of a role like that. We do point it out and we do go, okay, we don't get to see this character. Or Lin Shaye, you know, mm-hmm. Every time I see Lin Shaye in a movie, I'm like, fuck yeah, we need to see people in Lin Shaye's demographic leading movies because we don't get to see that story enough. But now we are getting a couple of those. And we should still keep advancing that along. And I think that's great. But what made this feel just as unique as the first time I saw a Lin Shaye leading a movie is this wasn't just an older woman who's the central character and carries the plot along. When that happens, it's usually about the woman's independence.
Right.
We find that when we talk about a lot of female-fronted movies. It's always like, what are we doing with this independent woman that's interesting?
Mm-hmm. Sure. And it's like, watch this movie smash the Bechdel test.
Yeah, totally. And I think it can be fascinating to watch a movie about a woman's lack of independence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is really somebody who is glued to her son in a very... in not a good way, Michael, in a bad way, one might say toxic way.
Mm-hmm.
And it is that bond that's also interesting because even when we see it from the younger male character's perspective, or we see a movie about sort of parenting or motherhood or just a mother-son, mother-daughter relationship, whatever it is, We also seem to ultimately land here. Here's maybe how the big dumb American version of this movie can go. We find that in the end, a mother will do anything to protect her child. And there's mm-hmm. kind of the movie. But instead of holding that premise up, I feel like the moral point that we kind of stick in this movie is going, oh, maybe that's not a good idea. If someone will go to, you know, salt the fucking earth to, even if they find out that their son is guilty,
right,
to still defend him at every turn, that doesn't feel like a nice, wonderful thing in this movie
mm-hmm.
the way it would in an easier movie. But of course, the plot of the movie is also more complicated than that. And that was another thing that just fucking surprised me. I mean, it's like, look at the last movie, very interesting execution on that plot, not entirely sure what the movie's about, so you don't know where it's going to go. Mother starts to fall into, oh, I might understand what this is. And the places it goes, not where I thought it would go.
Yeah.
And then the spins on that are also not what I thought they'd be. And it just keeps kind of pivoting and doing its own thing. And, you know, to me, that's the hardest thing to articulate about these movies today is a lot of movies are unique. In some way, every movie is, you know, to the truest sense of the word, unique. There is such a thing as more unique. And, you know, if you really need to defend that idea, which goes against the very definition of the word, look at films. You know, you see a movie like Mother, you see a movie like Barking Dogs, they just don't have, like, what is Mother? What's a movie like Mother?
Right.
You know, it's kind of, it's scary here and there. It's got its little pieces of that, but then it just starts playing like a David Fincher crime mystery for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And then it starts to align with like only in Korea type cinema. And then we see it against the sort of like, you know, maybe it's got a bumbling protagonist like The Host does. Oh, maybe it's doing a turn on that. And, you know, the whole thing plays it off, not like it's trying to make the weirdest movie ever, which is also almost a cliche.
Right.
And we do see those movies, especially out of Asia, actually. Maybe that's where my mind is at right now. But God, do we just see like wild Asian, crazy, I can't believe what this is even about, machine guns for arms. You know, it's not like the movie takes place on another planet or God even has a supernatural element, right?
Right.
So it's also so grounded. So to be so weird, but not so weird, you'd call the movie weird. To have such a distinct voice to it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the thing. The thing that I think stands out to me the most about Bong Joon-ho as a filmmaker broadly is that when I think of the gamut of his films, having seen, I think, nearly all of them now, I think I may be shy one and a third or something.
Mm.
I think of him as a director who employs a lot of sci-fi elements, horror elements, uses a lot of... what I don't want to say surreal because it's not surreal. Supernatural uses a lot of like supernatural aspects to their storytelling and their film. But then when I watch his movies, that's never there.
Yeah.
You know, like Parasite, I think of like, whoa, what a crazy supernatural.
Well, yeah, no, you like just keep wanting
people
to like
in a fucking house.
I know. It's crazy.
And you know, The Host has the thing and Snowpiercer obviously almost has a thing, but isn't, you know what I mean? It's,
yeah,
it feels like to me, Bong Joon-ho and Guillermo del Toro do the same shit in a different language, but they don't. I mean, maybe they do, but that language is not the language of their country. It's the language of their cinema.
Well, look at the context we've been talking about these movies in. It's like Fantastic Fest, Video on Demand,
right.
Dark Genre Festivals. You know, it's right alongside other movies that have a science fiction or a supernatural bent to them. And yeah, there's just all this cross-genre utilization. Usually, you know, I'm the one on here calling these movies that aren't horror movies all the fucking time. That's like my go-to thing. And you know, here's a filmmaker that we can really circle some of these scenes. the boiler, the fucking, well, there's tension in this movie that's just like the finger in water. The use of shadows feels like, you know, what we're used to seeing visually for a horror movie. Look at the fucking cover of this movie. You know, it even sort of says like dark thriller to it. And it does sincerely rely on this kind of tension that you feel in a movie like that. I think thriller is probably a better word than horror, but it is, Parasite is like the unspoken third movie in the double feature today. But it also has these kind of pulse racing, oh my God, will they be caught? Will the finger go in the water type moments? And it's all just serving the purpose of just making the movie as good as fucking possible. It all feels like, you know, distinct. It all feels unique, but it all feels like it's the best possible thing to go there at that moment. God, it's just it's such an exciting first look to really sit down and talk about this director kind of at length. And, you know, and to barely have hit on any of the themes of the movies, which again, I just feel like are so, you know, they're very verbose movies in that way. There's something that is thematically rich and is very much like the morality in these movies is interesting to me. His protagonists in every fucking movie, almost without failure, you know, we get these protagonists that have like some pretty deep moral. Mother has a deep moral issue to it, a deep kind of like, I don't know if I like this kid. I don't know if I like his mom. And Barking Dogs Never Bite is literally like, here's a guy, he murders dogs. Let's root for him. You know, it just seems like an impossible fucking task. If you sat down and you were just like, I got a movie, it's this guy, he murders dogs. And, you know, we're going to see him struggle and really like root for his success in any facet, even just a little bit. I'm going to be like, good fucking luck, man. Good luck making that movie.
And there it is.
We have a website, doublefeature.fm. Patreon is patreon.com/doublefeature. Thank you, thank you, thank you for getting us to the point where we have finally covered, and I'm happy doing, an entire director-centric episode.
Yeah, finally.
It really did feel good. It felt very good for my soul. I hope it felt good for the Patreons. Our executive producers are Abbot of Unreason, Charles Crawford, John, Tom Leonard, and Brett Hayden.
Hey!
Back from the dead. So thank you guys. You can sign up. It's patreon.com/doublefeature. All right, let's get the fucking subtitle out of this show. What are we, give me big movie, big giant movie
much
double feature.
Much to Eric's chagrin and much to what cinema looks like in the future, we're going to do Avatar next week on double feature. Avatar 2, 3, 4, and 5 are the next four movies to ever come out. So,
oh God, kill me.
I hope you're ready for that. So we're going to do Avatar with a film that Aaron Shore actually wanted us to do, called Greener Grass, which is a great movie. And we're actually in doing these movies. We're not talking about Avatar like the Avatar, but we are doing, sort of a, what it's like when you're not on this planet.
Right.
The planet that it feels like we're not on.
I felt for a long time like I'm not on this planet. So that's
and
very
that
good for me.
Is the fucking point.
Great.
Watch more fucking film.
All right, bye.
This program is a proud member of the Battleship Pretension Fleet.